Dr. Mitch Earlywine is a professor at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. We speak with Dr. Earlywine every Wednesday, usually in regards to cannabis and mental health. Today, we're featuring a longer interview that goes further into the news we've been highlighting this week. The rhetoric of super-potent BC Bud is circulating around again. Mitch has been gathering scientific evidence on marijuana potency, and we'll listen in on his findings. Also, the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment seeks to protect patients, and Dr. Earlywine helps us understand the science behind how people's brains and bodies benefit from cannabis. Mitch, thanks again for joining us here today on the Audio Stash. Let's take a look at this potency question. You've been gathering data in regards to the Alaska case where the Republican governor is repeating the rhetoric that somehow pot has become supercharged in the last 30 years. So what have you found out there?
It looks like the increase in potency is real, but nowhere near as large as folks have been led to believe. The problem is not that current estimates of potency are wrong, it's that the estimates of potency from 30 years ago are probably off. Back in the day when marijuana was being confiscated, it was often tossed in hot police evidence lockers and left there for a month before it was sent down to the University of Mississippi to have its potency assessed. Well, by then you can imagine a lot of the THC broke down, and so we get these reports that THC contents of marijuana in the 1970s was around 1%. When folks smoke marijuana that's 1% THC in the lab, they think they've been slipped a placebo, and they usually just get a headache. So it seems rather unlikely that that was the average marijuana potency back at that time. I think the tacit assumption behind this that is problematic is that stronger pot is supposed to be more dangerous, and that's really not the case at all. In fact, when you look at the way people smoke stronger pot in the laboratory, they take smaller puffs and hold their inhalations for a briefer time. And with that kind of smoking strategy, they in fact expose themselves to fewer of the things that might cause any respiratory problems like cough and phlegm and tightness in the chest.
When we talk about potency, they're citing like a 30% increase. Is that even possible?
As it turns out, with some of the new breeding and strains, getting things up in the 20% range is possible, but it's extremely rare. It's relatively unlikely. So I do see estimates 18-22%. But again, it's not that this pot is more dangerous, it's that it's in fact more effective and therefore requires less consumption.
All right, Mitch, could average consumers even grow this type of marijuana?
It would require a great deal of heat and a great deal of care and a great deal of luck. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but it would really, really require a full-time attention to your cannabis grow.
And when you have a high potency or higher THC content, what are the benefits, or is it better to have it at 5 or 6%?
In truth, THC isn't the only active component for some of the medical uses, so I think it's superb for some effects and then really almost irrelevant for some other effects. But the bottom line is that if you do need a THC administered, smoked cannabis can get it to you quickly and without a very large consumption if the THC content is high.
So basically, these claims that potency has increased is false. The BC Bud may look better every year, but it's not much more potent.
In fact, a lot of those haven't even had their potency assessed. It's just this tacit assumption that, oh, it's green and has a lot of resin, so it must be really potent. And then again, the bottom line is stronger pot is probably safer pot.
And anecdotally here, Mitch, how much of this is a cultural difference in connoisseurship here in the United States? I mean, wasn't it more common in the past, in the 70s, to have pot that was not nearly as manicured and looked as good, more plant material mixed in than bud?
Precisely. In fact, folks tell me about marijuana that they purchased in the 1970s that had quite a bit of stem and quite a bit of seed. And so you can imagine how, if that's interpreted as part of the potency estimate, that that's going to bring things down. And in truth, although we have lots and lots of new strains, a lot of them, it's not that there's more THC so much as other combinations of other cannabinoids or even other flavoring things that happen to participate in the way the cannabis is experienced, and it has nothing really to do with any kind of THC content at all.
And the growers have certainly made this strikingly different, visually gorgeous buds now.
It's funny how these colors now and some of the concentrations of some of the glands look so appealing. But again, very few people are actually estimating the THC content of every strain.
Again, we're speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, author of the book Understanding Marijuana. We've got links to buy it right on our website, normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, we've been focusing on the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment this week, and that seeks to protect medicinal patients from prosecution, federal prosecution. Let's talk about the science now behind how these patients are finding therapeutic relief from cannabis. One of the highest profile diseases for which marijuana is regularly used by patients is MS, or multiple sclerosis. And one of the most reported benefits is in regards to spasticity. Now, how does marijuana help, and what do these patients experience when they talk about spasticity?
Sure, you have to remember that MS is really a neurological disease, and so it can have impact in a whole bunch of different ways and be a little bit different for each individual who's experiencing it. The bottom line with the spasticity is not only are their muscles stiff and do they lose muscle tone, but occasionally the muscles will just twitch or jerk all of a sudden in the middle of for no reason at all. And you can imagine when you're asleep, this can really be disturbing and mess up your sleep. So medical cannabis is really superb for some people in eliminating this jerking and twitching. Tends to increase relaxation in general so that the muscle isn't contracted and hurting them, but also is a wonderful assistant to the sleep so that they can, rather than suffer through a night of insomnia, they can actually get the rest they need and wake up and have more energy and get more done in the day and really be much more positive in their outlook about their treatment and the world in general.
So what's actually happening chemically in the brain that cannabis has this effect?
In some ways, that's the most interesting part, is the cannabinoid receptor, the receptor that's all about THC and cannabis, is something we don't know that much about. We know it plays an important role in appetite and in the way muscle messages and nerve messages are sent, but we don't really know the exact neurotransmitters involved in every single effect of the plant, and I think that's part of the mystery and part of the reason why we need the plant rather than just a single extract from it. So some of the insomnia effects, for example, look like it's more involved with cannabidiol than THC, which is a completely different cannabinoid and another system potentially entirely. And that's why we really do need medical cannabis for these folks and not just some over-the-counter medication that's extracted only one component of its many magical substances.
And we discussed this last week in our talk about Marinol. So inhaled cannabis is providing a variety of positive chemicals. Also, Mitch, the MS patients and many others in clinical trials report relief from incontinence. How can marijuana help relieve incontinence?
It's funny because the incontinence literature is huge and there are new drugs developed for this all the time. But the bottom line on that is that there's an involuntary contraction of muscles and an involuntary relaxation of muscles associated with MS and a whole lot of spinal cord disorders and other disorders. And cannabis seems to keep that involuntary contraction and relaxation at bay. And it says something about how the cannabinoids play an important role in the way muscles contract that the literature still hasn't caught up with. We're still not exactly sure how it works. But literally hundreds of people have reported that this is a big benefit for them and one that they don't often, you know, bring up when they're discussing it at congressional hearings, but a very important impact nonetheless.
Now, we see a lot of darkly funny TV ads for prescription medications dealing with incontinence. They all have this long list of weird side effects.
In fact, each of those medications has got its own handful of side effects. And some are worse for some people than others. The biggest drawback for most of those is that they're orally administered, and so it takes a very long time for them to digest and to kick in and to have any impact, whereas inhaled cannabis vapor is, you know, something that can have a nice impact often within just a couple of minutes.
Let's talk for a moment about that, Mitch. What's going on here that makes those effects happen so rapidly when you inhale marijuana?
Well, the beauty of the inhalation administration is basically you inhale the vapor into your lungs, and then that blood in the lungs goes right to the brain so that it can have an impact on the areas that need it most, as opposed to swallowing a pill, having your stomach digest it, pass it on to the intestines, get it to the liver. You know, you can imagine that this is obviously going to take hours and hours, as opposed to a few seconds to a few minutes with an inhaled medication.
Let's also talk about one of the most important patient relief functions of cannabis, and that is pain relief. Across almost every clinical trial, almost everyone reports pain decrease with cannabis. So what is so effective about the analgesic qualities of marijuana?
That's the real beauty of this, is it's really effective for a whole bunch of different types of pain. So folks who say, I've got a sharp pain or a dull ache or a headache or things along those lines, and it doesn't work in the same mechanisms and in the same processes as the opiate drugs. We know the opiate drugs, all the things that are related to heroin and OxyContin and things like that, people develop tolerance to them really quickly. The dependence is relatively extreme. The withdrawal can be really unsettling. And use of cannabis is nowhere near as addictive or dependence-producing or problematic. The side effects are relatively mild and something folks that can get accustomed to really quickly. And if they do want to use opiate drugs, they tend to need far, far fewer if they're using cannabis in their battle against the pain as well.
In so many of these reports, I see that marijuana is particularly effective with cancer pain. Why are these patients finding such relief?
I mean, different types of cancer are different, of course. But that's often a kind of pain that's difficult to pinpoint. It's not that it's like you've stubbed your toe or it's all in one place. Often they report a full body kind of ache, and cannabis subjective effects have a full body effect as well. And that's relatively rare among all the painkillers, and the ones that also produce that are the ones that are the opiates, and they then have all these dependence problems that cannabis really does not.
And finally today, Mitch, all of this so far is involved inhaled or smoked cannabis, but there is some science out there for cannabis derivatives being injected directly into the brain to assist with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's disease treatment. Can you tell us a little bit about that research?
A lot of that work is still in the animal stages, but it's clear that the cannabinoid receptor has a lot to do with the way the brain is aging, the way neurons seem to degenerate. And there's some pretty compelling data that exposure to cannabinoids right after a nerve cell has been crushed can help that nerve cell recover or make the impact of that insult be extremely small. And I feel like this is something that I would love to see the government throw more money into, because this could save a whole lot of anguish and agony in the United States and the world over.
And I see a lot in this brain research the phrase neurogenesis. Mitch, can cannabis actually promote brain cell growth?
I don't want to give anybody the impression that getting high every day is somehow going to protect them against the normal memory deficits of aging. But there are clinical studies to suggest that cannabis-exposed nerve cells seem to grow and regenerate in ways that cells that haven't been exposed to cannabis just don't do.
Mitch, this has been a wonderful talk today. Thanks again for joining us here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Always a pleasure.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Earlywine is also a Normal Advisory Board member.